Rule 10. Plan and work diligently to maintain the romance in your relationship. The unbearable date. I am not a couples therapist, but sometimes when I see a client, it becomes necessary to include his or her intimate partner in one or more sessions. I do that only when directly asked. I also make it clear that the couple should seek out a marital counseling specialist if that is their central goal. However, if one of the primary problems my client is addressing is dissatisfaction in the marriage, it is often counterproductive to speak with only one member of the couple. Finally, it is often the case, and no wonder really, that the partner in question does not trust his or her better half's therapist, me, and a meeting with all three of us can go a long way toward rectifying that. Prior to meeting with a couple, I will have discussed some basic rules for relationship improvement with my client. Let us say he or she has decided to make some time for romance, 4 hours a week or something like that. I'm speaking here of adults with their full share of responsibilities. Maybe that much can be managed. Maybe even more is possible. But there is not that much time in 7 days, and the situation must be set up correctly and carefully. And when all this is first practiced, all this conscious negotiation and enactment, it is going to be done badly and stupidly with all the attendant pain, resentment, and vengefulness. And then such negative emotion can be nursed and the relationship damaged, sometimes permanently. Perhaps my client and his or her partner have become estranged from one another over several years when we first start to discuss their situation. They are not happy, and they hate me, maybe even more than they hate each other. They sit there, distant, arms crossed and eyes rolling. Hopefully not the latter. That is a bad sign. Neither will give an inch. I asked them when they last did something romantic together, when they last went out together for a date. They laugh ruefully if things have not gone too far, or scoff outright. I suggest, nonetheless, that they try going out with each other. Or more, that they start making dates a regular practice. The former suggestion is bad enough, the second intolerable. They indicate, "We are not going on any damn dates. We dated before we got married, when it was appropriate. Besides, all we will do is fight." And here is my take on that angry, bitter, and shallow response. This is the theory you are putting forth. You are never going to accompany each other on another date in your entire married life. So much for romance and intimacy. Instead, you're just going to give that up. Why not, instead, risk the time? Take each other somewhere nice. Dare to put your arm around your partner or your hand on a knee, and not your own either. I know you are angry with each other, and probably for good reason. I've met both of you. I understand why you feel that way. But just try it. You do not have to like it. You do not have to expect to be good at it, or give up your anger, or have a good time. You just have to tolerate it. They both leave incensed at me for suggesting such an irritating idea. But they agree grudgingly, and at their next session inform me. It happened just as we told you. We had an absolutely wretched time. We fought before we went out, while we were out, and again when we returned home. We are certainly not going to risk a date again. They often evince a certain pride at reaching such a conclusion, as both had generally decided ahead of time that the whole idea was pointless. So I ask, "That is the plan, is it? You're going to be married for 60 years. You put a small amount of begrudging effort into having one date. You were already not getting along, so there was a negligible probability you were going to take any pleasure in it. Besides that, irritated at me as you were for my childish suggestion, you were both motivated to make it go horribly, just as it did. So, you're done with it. And now you have decided that this is how you're going to conduct yourselves across the decades you have promised each other, with spite and bitterness, instead of mutual regard? Let us try thinking about it this way instead. Neither of you have any skill at dating. One attempt is therefore going to be insufficient. Maybe you need 15 dates, or 40, because you have lost the knack, need the practice, and must develop the habit and goodwill. Perhaps neither of you are very romantic to begin with, Or if you were once, those days have long gone. This is a skill you must learn, not an unearned gift from Cupid. Assume you are married, or the equivalent. Assume as well that you have or could have a romantic interlude twice a week. It may be less, it may be more, but we will do the arithmetic for twice weekly. That is 100 times a year. Let us imagine that you're going to be married 30 more years. 30 times 100 is 3,000 times. Is there not some possibility that you could devote a fraction of all the time to perfecting your techniques of seduction, communication, and lovemaking? What does it matter, therefore, if you have 15 miserable dates before managing one that verges on acceptable? That's 15 times out of a possible 3,000. That is 0.5% of the romantic time you could possibly spend together. Maybe you could dare even more to determine if things could be set right between you. Why would you possibly assume that something as complex as maintaining a marriage could be managed without commitment, practice, and effort? So maybe the first date is wretched and horrible. You never want to repeat it, but you do because you would rather save your marriage than quit outright. And maybe the next one is 5% better. And maybe after some repeated attempts, you remember for at least a brief moment why you once liked the person you married. Perhaps you manage something a little more exciting than putting your arm around him or her, and perhaps receive a bit of response from someone who actually cares for you somewhere in their now cold and shriveled heart. And if you are in it for the long run, as indicated by the original marital vows, perhaps you will put in the time to get it right. And maybe the couple has enough sense to do the arithmetic and contemplate all that wasted time, as well as the bitterness, resentment, and deadness of life without romance, and they agree to go on another date, or two, or three, or 10. And by the 10th session, they come to see me smiling and tell me they had a pretty good time. And then we have an even more serious discussion about just what it takes to maintain love and respect and invoke desire and response. How do you find the mystery in the other person over the long run? Can you muster up the will and the romantic imagination and the playfulness to manage that each time you are together intimately for the next 3,000 occasions? That is going to require some thoughtful effort. For each person is, in truth, an unfathomable enigma. With care, you might keep rediscovering in the person you have chosen enough residual mystery to maintain the spirit that first brought you together. With care, you can avoid stowing each other away in a conveniently sized box, punishment at hand should either of you dare to emerge, and contempt for the consequent predictability you now both face, lurking not so far beneath the surface. If you are fortunate, you might rekindle that glimpse you had when you first were attracted to each other of what your life could be like if you were better people than you are. That is what happens when two people fall under the spell of love. For a while, both become better than they were and see that. But then that magic fades away. Both receive that experience as a gift. Both have their eyes opened and can see what is visible to no one else. Such love is a glimpse of what could be if the relationship remained true. It is delivered as a gift initially from fate, but requires tremendous effort to realize and maintain. And once that is understood, the goal is clear. Bedrock. The sexual aspect of a relationship can often tell us a great deal about the whole, but not always. I have known couples who fought like proverbial cats and dogs and who had a wildly successful sex life, at least in the short term, and other couples who were well suited to each other temperamentally, but one or the other could not find the spark. People and their relationships are too complex to reduce to a single aspect. But it is still reasonable to note that a good marriage is accompanied by mutual desire, mutually requited. Unfortunately, desire is not something that can be managed by itself. Let us fix our sex life is a resolution too narrow in ambition to fulfill its aim. There must be a broader, relationship-wide strategy in place to maintain romance with your partner across time. Regardless of what that strategy might be, Its success is going to depend on your ability to negotiate. To negotiate, you and the person you are negotiating with must first know what you each need and want, and second, be willing to discuss both forthrightly. There are many serious obstacles both to knowing what you need and want, and to discussing it. If you allow yourself to know what you want, then you will also know precisely when you are failing to get it. You will benefit, of course, because you will also know when you have succeeded. But you might also fail, and you could well be frightened enough by the possibility of not getting what you need and want that you keep your desires vague and unspecified. And the chance that you will get what you want if you fail to aim for it is vanishingly small. Aim is likely a problem for you. If you have a partner, the problem may be compounded. The person you have chosen is unlikely to be any smarter about you than you are, except in minor instances, and is in fact likely to be even more in the dark with regard to your innermost desires. Your failure to specify your desires means your unfortunate lover will have to guess what would please and displease you, and is likely to be punished in some manner for getting it wrong. Furthermore, given all the things you could want and do not want, it is virtually certain that your lover will get it wrong. In consequence, you will be motivated to blame them, at least implicitly or non-verbally or unconsciously, for not caring enough to notice what you are unwilling even to notice yourself. If you really loved me, you will think or feel without thinking, I would not have to tell you what would make me happy. This is not a practical approach to a happy marriage. That is all bad enough. But there's a second and equally severe problem lurking in the byways. If you have solved the problem of knowing what you want, admitted it to yourself in a verbalizable form, and let someone else know your wishes, you have then granted them a dangerous source of power. The person whom you have made your confidant is now in a position to fulfill your desires, but could equally deprive you of what you want, embarrass you for wanting it, or hurt you in some manner, because you have now made yourself vulnerable. Naive people are possessed of the delusion that everyone is good and that no one, particularly someone loved, would be motivated to cause pain and misery, either for revenge, as a consequence of blindness, or merely for the pleasure of doing so. But people who have matured enough to transcend their naivety have learned that they can be hurt and betrayed both by themselves and at the hands of others. So, why increase the odds of being hurt? By letting someone in. It is to defend against such betrayal that naivete is often replaced by cynicism, and it must be said in all truth that the latter is an improvement over the former. But such substitution is not the final word in wisdom, and thank God for that. Trust, in turn, trumps cynicism, and true trust is not naive. Trust between people who are not naive is a form of courage. Because betrayal is always a possibility, and because this is consciously understood. This applies with particular force within the confines of an intimate relationship. To trust is to invite the best in your partner to manifest itself, with yourself and your freely given trust as the enticement. This is a risky business, but the alternative is the impossibility of true intimacy, and the sacrifice of what could have been two minds in dialogue working in tandem to address the difficult problems of life for a single mind striving in solitude. Romance requires trust, and the deeper the trust, the deeper the possibility for romance. But trust has its requirements as well, apart from the courage required of the individuals wise enough to distrust, but brave enough to risk putting their faith in a partner. The first of those requirements is truth. You cannot maintain trust in yourself if you lie. You cannot maintain trust in yourself likewise if you act in a manner that would require a lie if it was discovered. Similarly, you cannot maintain trust in your partner if he or she lies or betrays you in action or in silence. So, the vow that makes a marriage capable of preserving its romantic component is first and foremost the decision not to lie to your partner. There are also immense practical advantages to this, if practiced properly. There will come a time in your life when you have done something you should not have done, or failed to do something that you should have done. You may need advice. You may need support. You may need exactly what your partner could provide, if only you dared to allow them to help. And at some time, they are going to find themselves in exactly the same position. Life is too difficult to negotiate alone. If you tell your partner the truth, and you strive to act so that you can tell the truth about how you act, then you have someone to rely on when the seas become high and your ship threatens to founder. This can literally be a matter of life or death. In a relationship where romance remains intact, truth must be king. Christ in the candle. I have a friend of Scandinavian descent, although he is Canadian. He married a Canadian woman, also of Scandinavian descent. They decided to get married in Sweden as a tribute to their joint ancestry. They were both at least nominally Christian, so they were married in a ceremony reflecting that. During their exchange of vows, the bride and groom held a lit candle aloft between them. I spent a long time thinking about the significance of that ritual. There is an ancient conceit in the book of Genesis 2:21-22, that Eve was taken out of Adam, created from his rib. Woman from man. This presents something of a mystery, reversing, as it does, the normative biological sequence where males emerge from females at birth. It also gave rise to a line of mythological speculation attempting to account for the strangeness of this creative act, predicated on the supposition that Adam, the original man produced by God, was hermaphroditic, half masculine and half feminine, and only later separated into the two sexes. This implies not only the partition of a divinely produced unity, but the incompleteness of man and woman until each is brought together with the other. The fact that the candle is held jointly indicates the binding of the two celebrants. The fact that the candle is held aloft, lit, implies that something higher, something superordinate, is representing or performing the union. That is light, light in the heavens, light in the darkness, illumination, enlightenment. Something similar is symbolized by the use of candles at Christmas. Evergreens, the standard choice for Christmas trees, represent life unending as they do not die annually in the same manner as their deciduous counterparts. Such trees, therefore, symbolize the tree of life, which serves as the very foundation of the cosmos. We illuminate the tree of life with candles at or near December 21st, the darkest time of the year, at least in the Northern Hemisphere. That is also why Christmas is located where it is on the calendar. The reappearance of the light is associated with the birth of the universal Savior, signifying the eternal reemergence of light in the Stygian blackness. Christ has long been regarded as the second perfected Adam, and, just as there was speculation about the hermaphroditic nature of the first Adam prior to God's creation of the independent sexes, there is a line of speculation about Christ's spiritual perfection being a consequence of the ideal balance of masculine and feminine elements. It is very difficult for individuals joining themselves together to become desperate enough to cease their hiding and avoidance, live in truth, and repair themselves in the light cast by their joint existence. It is for this reason that both swear the dread vow of permanence. What God has joined together, let not man put asunder. Matthew 19:6. I am bound to you, claims one party to the agreement, and I to you, says the other. And both think, if they have any sense, that they should each transform themselves and one another to forestall any unnecessary suffering. So, what is the superordinate principle to which both marital partners must bow? It is not illumination as mere verbal abstraction. It is not that they are only supposed to think and speak the truth. It is that they are supposed to act it out. And that is the ancient idea that the word should be made flesh. The individuals who make up a married couple might well engage in a lifelong struggle concerning a single, inappropriately conceptualized question. Who is subordinate to whom in a marriage? After all, each might reason, as people commonly do, that such an arrangement is a zero-sum game, with one winner and one loser. But a relationship does not have to be and should not be a question of one or the other as a winner, or even each alternating in that status in an approximation of fairness. Instead, the couple can decide that each and both are subordinate to a principle, a higher order principle, which constitutes their union in the spirit of illumination and truth. That ghostly figure, the ideal union of what is best in both personalities, should be constantly regarded as the ruler of the marriage, and, indeed, as something as close to divine as might be practically approached by fallible individuals. That is what the ceremony of the candle represents. Neither participant rules the other. Instead, both bow to the principle of illumination. In that circumstance, it is not that one must abide by what the other wants, or vice versa. Instead, it is that both should be oriented toward the most positive future possible and agree that speaking the truth is the best pathway forward. That orientation and truthfulness will engender a transformative dialogue, verbal and nonverbal, if the partners in the arrangement commit to abiding by the consequence of that dialogue. Voluntary subordination to this higher order principle of illumination both unifies and revitalizes. Imagine that you have just participated in such a ceremony. What does your participation signify? Do you believe in the ideas that you have just acted out? Do you believe that man and woman were once together as a single being, were then separated, and must be restored as a unity? You can believe it dramatically, poetically, and metaphorically instead of merely rationally and mechanically, and that can lead you to deep truths. Do you want to find your soulmate? It is a romantic trope, obviously, but there are deep reasons for the existence of romantic fictions. Maybe you take someone on a date to a romantic movie. You both watch the movie hero and heroine find their soulmates. If you are fortunate, while you are watching, you are thinking, well, maybe this person I'm sitting with is the one for me, too. In the best of all situations, that is also what your date is hoping for. Maybe that is too much to hope for in real life, but the romantic part of you is longing for it, regardless. There is an inevitable yearning in our natures for the completion that someone else might provide. There is a sense that you are missing something otherwise, and that only the proper romantic union will provide it. It is true, too. You are, indeed, missing something. If you were not, sex would have never evolved. The entire biological course of our destiny, since reproduction progressed past the mere division of cells, appears driven by the fact that it was better for two dissimilar creatures to come together to produce a comparatively novel version of themselves than to merely clone their current embodiment. You have your idiosyncrasies, your blind spots, your biases. Some of these are implicit. They are often paired inextricably with your unique talents. You seldom gain an advantage without a corresponding disadvantage, and you are a particular person with particular attributes. If you are on your own, you are inevitably lopsided, one-sided. That is often not for the best. There is unrealized utility in the marital institution about which we have become cynical, a consequence of our immaturity and naivety. A marriage is a vow, and there is a reason for it. You announce jointly, publicly, I am not going to leave you in sickness or health, in poverty or wealth, and you are not going to leave me. It is actually a threat. We are not getting rid of each other no matter what. You are shackled together like two angry cats at the bottom of a barrel with the lid on. In principle, there is no escape. If you have any sense, beside the optimism of new love, you also think, oh God, that is a horrifying possibility. The part of you that claims to desire freedom, but really wants to avoid any permanent and therefore terrifying responsibility, desires a trapdoor through which escape might be made if and when it is necessary. That seems convenient, and it is true that there are unbearable marriages, but it is an option with extreme perils. Do you really want to keep asking yourself for the rest of your life, because you would always have the option to leave, if you made the right choice? In all likelihood, you did not. There are 7 billion people in the world. At least 100 million, let us say, might have made good partners for you. You certainly did not have time to try them out, and the probability that you found the theoretically optimal person approaches zero. But you do not find so much as make, and if you do not know that, you are in real trouble. Furthermore, if you have an escape route, there will not be enough heat generated in the chamber you find yourselves jointly trapped in to catalyze the change necessary in both of you, the maturation, the development of wisdom. Because maturation and the development of wisdom require a certain degree of suffering, and suffering is escapable as long as there is an out. You are not going to get along with your partner, because you are different people. Not easily, anyway, unless you agree to be tyrannized and silent, and even then you will take your revenge. No one just simply gets along, precisely because of that. And not only are you different from your partner, but you are rife with inadequacies, and so is he or she. And that is not bad enough. There is also the fact that even people of good will and character locked together in matrimony will face the mundane, quotidian, dull, tragic, and terrible together, because life can be, and certainly will be at some point, difficult to the point of impossibility. It is going to be tough. Even if you strive to pull yourselves together and succeed at that admirably, there are going to be brutal times, and they are not necessarily going to be brief. Maybe life will be better if you stay together. That is the hope and the likelihood, as far as I can tell. But the brutal times will still be there. What is going to make you voluntarily deal with your differences and establish a genuine agreement, a true consensus? You are going to have to negotiate in good faith continually to come to some sort of peaceful and productive accommodation. And if you do not, you are going to have your hands around each other's throats for 60 years. In clinical practice, I have seen whole families in that situation. Imagine five people in a circle. Imagine, further, that each has their hands around the neck of the person in front of them. All are squeezing with just enough force to kill in a few decades. This is a decision formulated over years of unspoken argument and refusal to negotiate. I am going to kill you. It is just going to take me a lifetime. It is very possible that you have someone you might like to slowly throttle in your family or who is currently doing it to you. Perhaps not. Hopefully not. Perhaps you would not admit it, even if you knew it was true. But it is common enough. If you do not negotiate peace with your partner, that is the situation you will find yourself in. There are three fundamental states of social being. Tyranny. You do what I want. Slavery. I do what you want. Or negotiation. Tyranny is obviously not so good for the person enslaved, but it is also not good for the tyrant, because he or she becomes a tyrant, and there is nothing ennobling about that. There is nothing but cynicism, cruelty, and the hell of unregulated anger and impulsivity. Slavery is not good either, likewise for the slave and the tyrant. Slaves are miserable, wretched, angry, and resentful. They will take any and all chances whatsoever available to them to take revenge on their tyrants, who will in consequence find themselves cursed and damaged by their slaves. It is not easy to get the best out of someone by arbitrarily brandishing a stick at them, particularly when they try to do something good, and that diminution of spirit is the cruelest trick of the tyrant. But you can be certain you want to be tyrants, that your slaves will take their revenge where they can, even if that means merely being much less than they could be. My wife told me a terrible story once about a couple she observed while volunteering in a palliative care ward. The husband was dying, and his wife was trimming his nails, a little too close. With each clip, there was blood as she trimmed close enough to damage the quick. You see something like that, and wisdom speaks its terrible truth. I know exactly what is going on there. That is the end stage of an unbelievably deceitful and brutal relationship. It is subtle. It does not announce itself loudly as murderous. No one knows, except the couple, even though they are perhaps striving with all their might under the circumstances not to know, and the careful observer, who sees a dying man and a wife who has determined, for whatever reasons, to make his death a little worse. That is not a desirable outcome. You do not want to end up in that situation or anything like it. You want to negotiate. The question is, what is going to make you desperate enough to negotiate? And that is one of the mysteries that must be addressed if you wish to keep the romance alive in your relationship. Negotiation, tyranny, or slavery? Negotiation is exceptionally difficult. We already discussed the problems associated with determining what you want and then mustering up the courage to tell someone exactly that. And there are the tricks that people use, too, to avoid negotiation. Perhaps you ask your partner what he or she wants, perhaps during a difficult situation. "I don't know," is a common answer. You get that from children, too, and even more often from adolescents. It is not acceptable, however, in a discussion that cannot in good faith be avoided. Sometimes, "I don't know" truly means what it is supposed to mean. The person who utters the phrase is at a genuine loss. But often it means instead, "I don't want to talk about it, so go away and leave me alone." Irritation or outright anger, sufficient to deter the questioner, often accompanies this response. That brings the discussion to a halt, and it can stay halted forever. Maybe that has happened once or twice or a dozen times too often. So you, the questioner in this instance, have had enough of your partner's refusal, and you have decided that you are done being cowardly or a victim of your own misplaced compassion, and you are not about to take "I don't know" for an answer. In consequence, you persist in pursuing your target. "Well, guess," you might say. "Throw something on the table, for God's sake. I do not care what it is. Even if it is wrong, it is at least a start." "I don't know" means not only "go away and leave me alone." It also frequently means, "Why don't you go away? Do all the work necessary to figure out what is wrong, and come back and tell me if you're so smart." Or, "It is intolerably rude of you to refuse to allow me to remain in my willful or dangerous ignorance, given that it obviously bothers me so much to think about my problems." It is not rude, though. Or, even if it is, you still need to know what your partner wants, and so does he or she. And how in the world are either or both of you going to figure it out if you cannot even get the conversation off the ground? It is not rude. It is a cruel act of love. Persistence under such conditions is a necessity, a terrible necessity, akin to surgery. It is difficult and painful because it takes courage and even some foolhardiness to continue a discussion when you have been told in no uncertain terms by your partner to go the hell away, or worse. It is a good thing, however, an admirable act, because a person bothered by something they do not wish to talk about is very likely to be split internally over the issue at hand. The part that wants to avoid is the part that gets angry. There is a part that wants to talk, too, and to settle the issue, but doing so is going to be cognitively demanding, ethically challenging, and emotionally stressful. In addition, it is going to require trust, and people test trust, not least by manifesting anger when approached about something touchy, just to determine if the person daring the approach cares sufficiently to overcome a serious barrier or two or three or ten to get to the horrible bottom of things. An avoidance followed by anger is not the only trick in the book. The next serious hurdle is tears. Tears are easily mistaken for the distress due to sadness, and they are very effective at bringing tender-hearted people to a dead halt as a consequence of their misplaced compassion. Why misplaced? Because if you leave the person alone because of their tears, they quit suffering right then, but continue with their unresolved problem until they solve it, which might be never. Tears, however, are just as often anger, perhaps more often, as they are sadness or distress. If the person you are chasing down and cornering is red-faced, for example, in addition to their tears, then he or she is probably angry, not hurt. That is not inevitably the case, but it is a reasonably common sign. Tears are an effective defense mechanism, as it takes a heart of stone to withstand them, but they tend to be the last-ditch attempt at avoidance. If you can get past tears, you can have a real conversation. But it takes a very determined interlocutor to avoid the insult and hurt generated by anger, defense one, and the pity and compassion evoked by tears, defense two. It requires someone who has integrated their shadow, their stubbornness, harshness, and capacity for necessary emotionless implacability, and can use it for long-term benefit. Do not foolishly confuse nice with good. Remember the options previously discussed: negotiation, tyranny, or slavery. Of these, negotiation is the least awful, even though it is no joke to negotiate. It is also the most difficult of the three, at least in the short term, because you have to fight it out now, and God only knows how deep you are going to have to go and how much diseased tissue you will have to remove. For all you know, you are fighting with the spirit of your wife's grandmother, who was treated terribly by her alcoholic husband, and the consequences of that unresolved abuse and distrust between the sexes have echoed down the generations. Children are amazing mimics. They learn much of what they know implicitly long before they can use language, and they imitate the bad along with the good. It is for this reason that it has been said that the sins of the fathers will be visited on the children to the third and fourth generation. Numbers 14:18. Hope, of course, can drive us through the pain of negotiation, but hope is not enough. You need desperation as well, and that is part of the utility of "till death do us part." You are stuck with each other if you are serious, and if you are not serious, you are still a child. That is the point of the vow, the possibility of mutual salvation, or the closest you can manage here on earth. In a truly mature marriage, if your health holds out, you are there for the aforementioned 60 years, more time than Moses spent in the desert searching for the promised land, and there is plenty of trouble that must be worked through before peace might be established. So, you grow up when you marry, and you aim for peace as if your soul depends on it, and perhaps that is more serious than your life depending on it, and you make it work or you suffer miserably. You will be tempted by avoidance, anger, and tears, or enticed to employ the trapdoor of divorce, so that you will not have to face what must be faced. But your failure will haunt you while you are enraged, weeping, or in the process of separating, as it will in the next relationship you stumble into with all your unsolved problems intact and your negotiating skills not improved a whit. You can keep the possibility of escape in the back of your mind. You can avoid the commitment of permanence, but then you cannot achieve the transformation, which might well demand everything you can possibly muster. Remember, the difficulty implicit in the negotiation carries with it a tremendous promise, which is part of a radically successful life. You could have a marriage that works. You could make it work. That is an achievement, a tangible, challenging, exceptional, and unlikely achievement. There are not many genuine achievements of that magnitude in life. Maybe, if you strive for it, you have established a solid marriage. That is one achievement. Because of that, you have founded a solid and reliable, honest and playful home into which you could dare bring children. Then you can have kids, and with a solid marriage, that can work out for you. That is another achievement. Then you have brought upon yourself more of the responsibility that will demand the best from you. Then you will have new relationships of the highest quality if you are fortunate and careful. Then you will have grandchildren so that you are surrounded by new life when yours begins to slip away. In our culture, we live as if we are going to die at 30, but we do not. We live a very long time, but it is also all over in a flash. You should be careful, therefore, to live your life fully. And marriage and children and grandchildren and all the trouble and heartbreak that accompanies all of that is much of what life has to offer. Miss it at your great peril. You meet people, usually young, unwise, but laden with the unearned cynicism that substitutes for wisdom in youth, and they say, categorically, even pridefully, "I do not want children." Plenty of 19-year-olds say that, and that is acceptable in some sense because they are 19 and they have time and what do they know at 19 anyway? And some 27-year-olds say that, but not so many, particularly if they are female and the least bit honest with themselves. And some 45-year-olds say the same thing in the past tense, and some of them perhaps are telling the truth. but most are celebrating closing the barn door after the cattle have bolted. No one will speak the truth about this. To note outright that we lie to young women, in particular, about what they are most likely to want in life, is taboo in our culture, with its incomprehensibly strange insistence that the primary satisfaction in the typical person's life is to be found in career, a rarity in itself, as most people have jobs, not careers. But it is an uncommon woman, in my clinical and general professional experience. Regardless of brilliance or talent, training, discipline, parental desire, youthful delusion, or cultural brainwashing, who would not perform whatever sacrifice necessary to bring a child into the world by the time she is 29 or 35 or worse, 40. Here is a pathway to misery I would strongly recommend avoiding, aimed primarily at the women who read this book, although wise boyfriends and husbands should take equal note. Decide that you want children when you are 29 or 30, and then be unable to have them. I would not recommend that. You will not recover. We are too fragile to play around with what life might offer us. Everyone thinks when they are young and do not know any better, well, pregnancy can be taken for granted. That is only true if you absolutely do not want and should not have a child, and you have sex in the backseat of a car when you are 15. Then, for sure, you will find yourself in trouble. But a successful pregnancy is not a foregone conclusion, not by any stretch of the imagination. You can push trying for children to the older end of the fertility range, and many people are encouraged or encourage themselves to do exactly that, but up to 30% of couples experience trouble becoming pregnant. You encounter something similar, that is, the incaution about what life will and will not offer, when people whose marriages have stagnated begin to develop the delusion that a romantic affair will address their unmet needs. When I had clients considering such a move, or perhaps involved in an affair currently, I tried to bring them back down to earth. Let us think it through, all the way, not just for this week or this month. You are 50. You have this 24-year-old, and she is willing to break up your marriage. What is she thinking? Who must she be? What does she know? Well, I'm really attracted to her. Yes, but she has a personality disorder. Seriously, because what the hell is she doing with you? And why is she willing to break up this marriage? Well, she does not care if I stay married. Oh, I see. So she does not want to have an actual relationship with someone with any degree of long-term permanency. Somehow, that is going to work out well for you, is it? Just think about that. It's going to be a little rough on your wife. A lot of lies are going to go along with that. You have children. How are they going to respond when all this comes out, as it most certainly will? And what do you think about the 10 years in court that are now beckoning, that are going to cost you $333,000 and put you in a custody battle that will occupy all your time and attention? I have seen people who were in custody battles who would seriously have preferred cancer. It is no joke to have your arm caught in the dangerous machinery of the courts. You spend much of the time truly wishing you were dead. So that is your affair, for God's sake. It is even more delusional than that, because of course if you are married to someone, you often see them at their worst, because you have to share the genuine difficulties of life with them. You save the easy parts for your adulterous partner. No responsibility, just expensive restaurants, exciting nights of rule-breaking, careful preparation for romance, and the general absence of reality that accompanies the privilege of making one person pay for the real troubles of existence while the other benefits unrealistically from their absence. You do not have a life with someone when you have an affair with them. You have an endless array of desserts, at least in the beginning, and all you have to do is scoop the whipped cream off the top of each of them and devour it. That is it. You see each other under the best possible conditions, with nothing but sex on your minds and nothing else interfering with your lives. As soon as it transforms from that into a relationship that has any permanency, a huge part of the affair immediately turns right back into whatever it was that was bothering you about your marriage. An affair is not helpful, and people end up horribly hurt, particularly children, and it is to them you owe primary allegiance. I am not trying to be unreasonably categorical about marriage and family. You cannot expect every social institution to work out for everyone. Sometimes you have married someone who is a psychopathic brute, a congenital and incorrigible liar, a criminal, an alcoholic, a sadist, and maybe all five at once. Then you must escape. But that is not a trapdoor. That is a catastrophe, like a hurricane, and you should move out of its path. You might be tempted to conclude, well, how about we live together instead of getting married? We will try each other out. It is the sensible thing to do. But what exactly does it mean when you invite someone to live with you instead of committing yourself to each other? And let us be appropriately harsh and realistic about our appraisal instead of pretending we are just taking a used car for a jaunt. Here is what it means. You will do, for now, and I presume you feel the same way about me. Otherwise, we would just get married. But in the name of a common sense that neither of us possesses, we are going to reserve the right to swap each other out for a better option at any point. And if you do not think that is what living together means, as a fully articulated ethical statement, see if you can formulate something more plausible. You might think, look, Doc, that is pretty cynical. So why not consider the stats instead of the opinion of arguably, but not truly, old-fashioned me? The breakup rate among people who are not married but are living together, so married in everything but the formal sense, is substantially higher than the divorce rate among married couples. And even if you do get married and make an honest person, so to speak, of the individual with whom you cohabited, you are still much more likely to get divorced than you would be had you never lived together initially. So, the idea of trying each other out sounds enticing, but does not work. It is, of course, possible that people who are more likely to get divorced are also more likely to live together before or without marriage, rather or in addition to the possibility that living together just does not work. It is no simple matter to disentangle the two causal factors. But it does not matter practically. Cohabitation without the promise of permanent commitment, socially announced, ceremonially established, seriously considered, does not produce more robust marriages. And there is nothing good about that, particularly for children who do much worse in single-parent, generally male-absent, families. So I just do not see it as a justifiable social alternative. And I say that as someone who lived with my wife before I married her. I am not innocent in this regard. But that does not mean I was right. And there is something else, and it is far from trivial. You just do not have that many chances in life to have an intimate relationship work out properly. Maybe it takes you 2 or 3 years to meet the potential Mr. or Ms. Right, and another 2 to 3 to determine if they are in fact who you think they are. That is 5 years. You get old a lot faster than you think you will, no matter how old you are now, and most of what you could do with your family, with marriage, children, and so forth, is from 20-something to about 35. How many good 5-year chances do you therefore have? 3? 4 if you are fortunate? This means that your options decrease as you wait rather than increase. If you are a widower or a widow and you must hit the dating scene when you were 40 or 50, so be it. You've been struck by tragedy, and that is life. But I have watched friends do it, and it is not a fate I would casually wish on anyone I loved. Let us continue to be reasonable about this. All 16 to 18-year-olds have much in common. They are unformed. They are malleable. That is not an insult. It is just a fact. It is also why they can go off to college and make a lifelong friend, no cynicism whatsoever intended, from a roommate within a single semester. By the time you are in your mid-40s, however, if you have lived at all, you have become somewhat of a singular and unique person. I have known people I met at that time of my life for a decade or more, whom I still seem to consider new acquaintances. That is a pure function of the complexity of increasing age. And that is mere friendship, not love, not a joint life, and perhaps even the bringing together of 2 disparate families. And so you have your marriage and your children, and that is working out well because you are stubborn and sufficiently terrified of the hell that awaits anyone who fails to negotiate for peace and make the sacrifices necessary to establish it. You are undoubtedly more prepared now for your career, or more likely, your job. That is another major achievement you might manage, with good fortune and an undaunted spirit, in the brief flash of your existence. You have learned how to establish productive harmony in the close confines of your most intimate and private relationships, and some of that wisdom spills over into your workplace. You are a mentor for younger people, a helpful peer and reliable subordinate, and instead of the hash you could so easily make of the place you inhabit, you improve it. And if everyone did that, the world would be a much less tragic and unhappy place. Maybe it would even be a self-evidently good place. And perhaps you learn how to make good use of your time away from family and work, your leisure, and you make that meaningful and productive. And that is perhaps the final of life's fundamental achievements, and one, like the others, that can grow. Perhaps you get better and better at such things so that you can work on solving more and more difficult problems and become a credit in your own way to the spirit of humanity itself. And that is life. Back to marriage. How do you plan and diligently maintain the romance in your relationship? Well, you have to decide. Do you want some romance in your life or not? If you really think about it, without resentment, without the joy of depriving your partner, now alienated, of the pleasure that might come with such an attempt, the answer is generally yes. Sexual romance. The adventure, pleasure, intimacy, and excitement people fantasize about experiencing when they are feeling in need of a touch of the divine. You want that. The joys of life are rare and precious, and you do not want to forsake them without due cause. How are you going to accomplish that? With luck, it will happen between you and someone you like. With better luck and sufficient commitment, it will happen between you and someone you love. Little about this is easy. If you set up a household with someone, you're going to have to do an awful lot of negotiation to keep both like and love alive. The domestic economy. Here are some practical considerations. They may seem far from the topic of romance. The discussion is necessary, however, because we transcended or lost our traditional roles and have not formulated replacements for them. Before that happened, perhaps before the invention of the birth control pill, which was a biological revolution, men did male things, whatever they were, and women did female things, whatever they were. Traditional roles are far more helpful than modern people, who vastly overestimate their tolerance for freedom and choice, tend to realize. In a less rapidly mutable society, everyone has some sense of their respective duties. That does not eliminate the tension. Nothing eliminates the tension, but at least there is a template. If there is no template for what either of you should be doing when you live together with someone, then you are required to argue about it, or negotiate about it if you're good at that, which you are probably not. Few people are. If you're going to set up a household in peace with someone you love and hopefully like and wish to continue loving and liking, you are going to have to determine in some manner who is going to do what. That is the replacement for roles. Who makes the bed? When should it be made? At what level of perfection does the bed have to be made to be mutually acceptable? And if this is not handled well, the conversation becomes counterproductive rapidly. I made the bed. Well, you did not do a very good job. Nothing's ever good enough for you. If you do not think I did a good enough job making the bed, maybe I'll just stop and you can make it yourself. Well, maybe you should raise your standards a bit, and maybe not just about the bed. It is going to take days to sort that out, if it ever does get sorted out, and that is just the bed. That is just the first 10 minutes of the morning. So maybe it remains unmade or made badly and bitterly for the next 60 years. There is that time span again. And there are many more domestic issues to address than just the bed. But if that is not sorted out, then it is a problem every morning of every day and every day of every week and month and year, and everyone is angry, at least under the surface, as soon as they awaken or every time they enter the bedroom, and other things begin to fall out of order. There's nothing good about that. Whose career is going to take priority? When and why? How will the children be educated and disciplined, and by whom? Who does the cleaning? Who sets the table, takes out the garbage, cleans up the bathroom? How are the bank accounts set up and managed? Who shops for groceries, clothes, furniture? Who pays for what? Who adopts responsibility for the taxes? Etc., etc., etc. 200 things, perhaps, to run a household properly. As complex a problem as running a business, with the additional difficulty of trying to manage it with a family member, much of it repeated daily. Your life is, after all, mostly composed of what is repeated routinely. You either negotiate responsibility for every single one of these duties, or you play push and pull forever while you battle it out non-verbally with stubbornness, silence, and half-hearted attempts at cooperation. That is not going to do your romantic situation any good. It is a vital necessity in consequence to place the domestic part of the household economy on firm ground. It is an incredibly difficult set of problems to solve, because it means you must consciously sort the hierarchy of responsibilities between the partners in the household. You are required to negotiate every damned and apparently trivial detail, but the apparent triviality is a delusion. Who prepares the meals? When do they prepare the meals? What is that worth in terms of trade-off for other tasks? How do you thank someone for conducting themselves properly in the kitchen? Who loads the dishwasher? Who does the dishes? How fast do the dishes have to be cleared off the table after you eat? Which dishes are going to be used? What are we going to eat? What role are the kids going to play? Do we sit down together? Do we have regular meal times? Each of these questions can become a bloody war. One person thinks one thing, and the other person thinks another thing, and who knows who's right? So, you have to struggle with it, and you have to come to a consensus. Doing so is difficult. Maybe it means hundreds of fights. It certainly means dozens. But they can be fights with a purpose, and that purpose is to fight it out until a solution arises, so that fights about that issue are no longer necessary. That makes peace the goal, and it cannot be established except through negotiation, and that requires a commitment strong enough to withstand serious and deep conflict. The next thing you have to do, I know this from both my clinical and marital experience, 30 years of each, is actually talk to your partner for about 90 minutes a week, purely about practical and personal matters. What is happening to you at work? What is going on, as far as you are concerned, with the kids? What needs to be done around the house? What do we have to do to keep the wolf from the door next week? Is there anything bothering you that we could address? Just pure practical communication. Partly because you have a story, your partner has a story, and you have a joint story. To know your story, you must tell it. And for your partner to know it, he or she must hear it. It is necessary for that communication to happen on an ongoing basis. It does not have to be 90 minutes all at once. Maybe it can be 15 minutes a day. But you keep those lines of pragmatic communication open so you know where the other person is and vice versa. If you dip below 90 minutes a week, you generate a backlog and your mutual story begins to unwind. At some point, that backlog is so large that you do not know who you are yourself, and you certainly do not know who your partner is, and you become mutually alienated. Your relationship loses its coherence. That is a bad situation. When I am helping someone straighten out their marriage, let us say, we do very mundane things. I am not interested in vacations, special occasions, or anything that happens that is out of the ordinary. It is not that those things are unimportant, but they are not vital in the same sense that daily routines are vital. It is the latter that must be set right. I want to know what interrelationships constitute the bulk of your typical day. You wake up together, perhaps. You eat together. You do such things every day. Maybe waking up, preparing for the day, and eating make up 5 hours a day. That is a third of your waking time, therefore a third of your life. It is 35 hours every 7 days, a whole work week, an entire career. Get it right. Ask yourself and each other, how do we want these times to be structured? How can we make the morning awakening pleasant? Can we attend to each other politely and with interest, and perhaps without electronic distractions while we eat? Could we make our meals delicious and the atmosphere welcoming? Consider coming home in the evening. Let us say that routine takes 10 minutes, so that is another hour plus per week, 50 hours a year, 1.5 work weeks. You spend 1.5 work weeks a year being greeted as you come in the door. It is a sizable fraction of your existence. Does somebody meet you at the door and indicate a certain degree of happiness to see you? Or are you met with a litany of complaints? Are you ignored, alternatively, because everyone is using their smartphones? How would you like to organize that so you do not dread the moment you arrive at home? There are things you do together that are mundane things, those things you do every day, but they are your whole life. You get those things right, and you have established yourself much more effectively than you might realize. If you can successfully fight the war that establishes harmony in the domestic economy, you have both won a major victory. And then you can concentrate on what might happen during a romantic vacation to a boutique hotel, or your parents' cottage, or an all-inclusive resort, or an adventure holiday, or just during that twice-weekly date we discussed earlier that you are both so reluctant to attempt. Start by getting these things straight and see what happens. Then you will have peaceful mealtimes, for example, and you will not die of frustration or high blood pressure. You will have to fight for such an accomplishment. What matters, however, is not whether you fight because you have to fight, but whether you make peace as a consequence. To make peace is to manage a negotiated solution, and you want and need to come to a negotiated solution about every responsibility and opportunity you share as a couple, and about every obstacle you encounter. At least then, you will have someone to talk things through with when your life gets complex, as it inevitably will, and you have the advantage of two heads, even though they will not see eye to eye. What all this means is that the problems of knowing what you want and discussing it with your partner must be solved before the romance in your relationship can be maintained. Other people keep you sane. That is partly why it is a good idea to get married. Why? Well, you are half insane, and so is your spouse. Well, maybe not half, but plenty. Hopefully, however, it is not generally the same half. Now and then you meet couples who have the same weakness, and they compound that failing in each other. Maybe they are both too fond of wine, for example, and they drift together toward alcoholism. What you might want to avoid such a fate is that one person in the couple is fond of alcohol, but not both. This will cause a certain amount of short-term conflict in situations where drinking is occurring or likely to occur, but the long-term consequences, avoiding either of you becoming an alcoholic, are likely to be beneficial. The one who does not drink will have a drink or two on a social occasion just to avoid being too rigid and horrible, and the one who likes to drink will get what is hopefully a salutary reprimand if he or she does not exercise proper control. It is a fortunate happenstance, generally speaking, that your idiosyncrasies are likely to be somewhat randomly distributed, and that if you unite with someone else, you are likely to find some strength where you are weak, and vice versa. When you unite the two of you to recreate that original divine being, that is the symbolic idea, then you have a chance of producing one reasonable, sane being. That is good for you both. Even better for your children, who now have a fighting chance of adapting to what constitutes generally sane behavior, and it is good for friendship and the broader world, too. A lot of that movement toward functional unity is a consequence of dialogue and communication. If you are old enough, you know that people are badly broken. When you are young and not very experienced, you are likely to make two assumptions in a rather unquestioning and implicit manner that are simply not true. The first is that there is someone out there who is perfect. You are likely even to encounter this hypothetically perfect person whom you view through your delusion and to fall desperately and foolishly in love with them. Foolishly, because you are in love with your projection of perfection rather than the person, which is very confusing to the target of your affection. The second assumption is that there is someone out there who is perfect for you. From these assumptions, you are deriving at least three errors, which is quite an accomplishment, given that you have made only two assumptions. To begin with, there is not anyone out there who is perfect. There are just people out there who are damaged, quite severely, although not always irreparably, and with a fair bit of individual idiosyncrasy. Apart from that, if there was someone out there who was perfect, they would take one look at you and run away screaming. Unless you are deceiving someone, why would you end up with anyone better than you? You should be truly terrified if you have been accepted as a date. A sensible person would think of their new potential romantic partner, "Oh my God, you are either blind, desperate, or as damaged as me." That is a horrifying idea, signing up with someone who is at least as much trouble as you. It is by no means as bad as being alone with yourself, but it is still out of the frying pan and into the fire, although at least the fire might transform you. Thus, you get married if you have any courage, if you have any long-term vision and ability to vow and adopt responsibility, if you have any maturity, and you start to transform the two of you into one reasonable person. And it is even the case that participating in such a dubious process makes the two of you into one reasonable person with the possibility of some growth. So, you talk about everything, no matter how painful, and you make peace, and you thank Providence if you manage it, because strife is the default condition. Finally, romance. There was not much point in this chapter in talking about romance immediately. At least not about its maintenance. Romance is play, and play does not take place easily when problems of any sort arise. Play requires peace, and peace requires negotiation. And you are lucky even then if you get to play. The issue of marital romance, intimacy, and sex is a complex one, with a dragon lurking under every question. For example, what do you owe each other sexually if you are entangled in a marriage? The answer is not no sex. That is not the answer, because part of the contractual arrangement is to organize your romantic life in a mutually satisfactory manner. It is an implicit precondition for the stability of the marriage. It is probably not sex 15 times a day, and it is probably not sex begrudgingly once a year. It is somewhere between extremes, and that is where you must begin to negotiate. My observation has been that the typical adult couple, when they have a job, children, and the domestic economy we just discussed, and all that worry and responsibility and concern, might manage once or twice a week, or even three times a week, not likely, for a reasonable romantic interlude. That frequency, if handled well, seems to work out acceptably for both partners. I have observed that twice is better than once, but once is much better than zero. Zero is bad. If you go to zero, then one of you is tyrannizing the other, and the other is submitting. If you go to zero, then one of you is going to have an affair, physical, emotional, fantastical, or some combination of the three. I do not say that lightly. Something has to give, and there has to be a no there somewhere when the romance disappears and the frequency of sexual intimacy hits rock bottom. There has to be a strong indication that this is not good enough. I am not recommending the affair, but that is what you are setting yourself up for if your sex life vanishes. Maybe you want to take that pathway and facilitate the affair because you want to play the martyr. My wife left me to have an affair, and poor me. And why did she do such a thing? Well, perhaps our sex life was not all it could have been. And this is an answer that may require a fair bit of digging. What exactly do you mean by was not all it could have been? Well, we had not made love for 2 years, and she went and had an affair. That is not a shock. You should begin by assuming that your partner is a relatively normal human being and that there is a certain amount of sexual satisfaction that is a reasonable requirement, let us say twice a week or once a week under conditions of intense busyness. In the early days of marriage, it might be no problem to express romantic interest in your partner, but there is so much that must be done to live. Dating is a pain, even if you are single. I am perfectly aware that there is adventure there, too, but a lot of that occurs in movies and not on internet dating sites, in text exchanges, coffee shops, restaurants, and bars where the first awkward encounters occur. You really have to work at it, and you will if you are single because you are lonesome, starved for attention, and desperate for physical intimacy. Single people have far less sex on average than married people, although I suppose that a small percentage are making out like bandits. But I cannot see that even those successful in that manner are doing themselves any favors. So, as a single person, you will work at dating because you are lonesome and deprived, but it is no simple matter. You must make space in your life for it. You have to plan. You must use your imagination, spend money, find an acceptable dating partner, and, as they say, kiss a lot of frogs to find a prince, or to find a princess as well. People are often relieved when they get married because they do not have to make all that so often counterproductive effort anymore. But that does not at all mean that you are now off the hook, that you can just lay back in your worn white underwear and socks and assume that all the hypothetical pleasures of Hugh Hefner are going to automatically manifest themselves in your household. There is still plenty of effort required unless you want the romance to vanish. You have to talk about it. You have to have the difficult and embarrassing conversation. What is it going to be, dear? Tuesday and Thursday? Wednesday and Friday? Monday and Saturday? You think, oh God, that is so cut and dried. That is so mundane and planned. That is so scheduled, predictable, bourgeois, anti-romantic, and robotic. It is demeaning and constricting, and it just turns sex into a duty. Where is the fun? Where is the spontaneity, the light jazz, cocktails, and excitement of sudden, unexpected attraction? Where is the tuxedo and the little black dress? That is what you expect? Even unconsciously in your foolish fantasies? How often did you manage that when you were dating? Ever? And remember, we are adults talking here. You want two jobs, two careers, two incomes, two kids, a reasonable standard of living, and spontaneity? And you're not about to settle for anything less. Good luck with that. It is not going to happen, not in my clinical and personal experience, not without a lot of effort. What will happen is that the absolute necessities of life will inexorably start to take priority over the desirable necessities. Maybe there is a list of 10 things you will do in a day, and sex is number 11. It is not that you do not think sex is important, but you do not ever get past number 5 on the list of 10. You must make space and time, and, as far as I can tell, you have to do it consciously. You might think, what would it be like to spend some time with this person I was once romantically attracted to? You have to think that through. Maybe you only have an hour and a half with your partner, or even an hour, because life is too hectic. It would not be too bad an idea to have a shower. A little lipstick, that could be good. Some perfume, some clothing that is attractive and erotic. Buy some lingerie for your wife, if you are a man, and wear it with some courage, if you are a woman. Maybe you, if you are a man, can find something to wear yourself that is reasonably sexy in a men's shop or a place that sells erotic clothing that is not too extreme and does not scream of poor taste and produce intense and counterproductive self-consciousness. And a compliment or two when all that courage is manifested is not such a bad idea. Maybe each time it happens for a year. You are trying to build some confidence. Try some nice soft lighting, maybe some candles. And someone has to buy the candles and should be encouraged to do so, and the cynicism should be kept to an absolute minimum if you do not want to banish what is fragile out of existence altogether. Here is a rule. Do not ever punish your partner for doing something you want them to continue doing, particularly if it took some real courage, some real going above and beyond the call of duty to manage. How about trying to set up the whole situation in the romantic manner that you might imagine if you were imagining having an affair? Because that is the sort of thing that people imagine when they imagine an affair, if they have any imagination. Try having an affair with your wife or husband. Maybe the latter can set up the bedroom while the former is preparing in the bathroom. We already mentioned candles. How about some music? How about making sure that the room is clean and, God willing, aesthetically attractive? That might be a start. And maybe the two of you will not get old and fat, unhealthy and hypochondriacal as fast as possible, just to spite each other, which many couples certainly do. And then, maybe, you could both have what you need, and maybe even what you want. but you would have to admit your desires and you would have to negotiate with your partner. What do you like? What does she like? And are you going to let each other know? Are you going to risk practicing badly? Are you going to learn some new tricks, even if you feel like a fool when you first try? None of this is easy. People will do things with or to each other that they will not talk about with each other, which is not helpful if they are married. It could be, maybe, if you were in a trading mood and approaching this with goodwill, that you could decide what you need and want and arrange exactly the right trade. You might ask yourself, look, how do I have to set this up so I am likely to continue being romantically interested in my wife or my husband for the next 60 years, so that I do not wander off and do something stupid, like so many people do? What is my minimal precondition for erotic satisfaction? You might try to convince yourself that it is not necessary, that you can put up with what you have, even if it is nothing. But you cannot. Not if you have any self-respect or sense. There is something that you are going to want and need. It is possible that, if you communicate openly what that something is, and at the same time leave yourself open to the same communication coming from your partner, that you both could get not only what you want from each other, but even more than you expect. Arrange some dates, and then practice making those dates and going on them until you are expert at it. Negotiate and practice that, too. Allow yourself to become aware of what you want and need and have the decency to let your partner in on the secret. After all, who else are you going to tell? Devote yourself to the higher ideal upon which an honest and courageous relationship is necessarily dependent, and do that with the seriousness that will keep your soul intact. Maintain your marital vows so that you are desperate enough to negotiate honestly. Do not let your partner brush you off with protestations of ignorance or refusal to communicate. Do not be naive, and do not expect the beauty of love to maintain itself without all-out effort on your part. Distribute the requirements of your household in a manner you both find acceptable, and do not tyrannize or subject yourself to slavery. Decide what you need to keep yourself satisfied both in bed and out of it, and maybe, just maybe, you will maintain the love of your life, and you will have a friend and confidant. And this cold rock we live on at the far end of the cosmos will be a little warmer and more comforting than it would be otherwise. And you are going to need that, because rough times are always on their way, and you better have something to set against them, or despair will visit and will not depart. Plan and work diligently to maintain the romance in your relationship.